From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
No one who sits in one of these public positions should steal, period. That's like, you know, you learn that when you're in second grade.
That's Governor Charlie Baker today announcing major changes in oversight of the Massachusetts State Police. We'll have the latest. Also today, you think you've heard it all about the science of dieting, but maybe not. Dr. David Katz answers everything you've ever wanted to know about nutrition. Plus, Eunice Kennedy Shriver. She founded Special Olympics in 1968.
The right to play on any playing field, you have earned it. The right to study in any school, you have earned it. The right to hold a job, you have earned it.
In a new biography, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eileen McNamara argues that Shriver had a far bigger impact on American life than any of the Kennedy men. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Governor Charlie Baker and the head of the Massachusetts State Police today announced the elimination of an entire state police troop, in addition to other sweeping changes in staffing, oversight, and audits of the state police. This is all following several major scandals involving overtime pay, including one where a separate troop's salaries were not reported to the state comptroller for years. Here's the governor in a press conference just this afternoon.
The colonel, Secretary of Public Safety Dan Bennett, and the command staff at the Massachusetts State Police have developed a comprehensive plan to address the supervisory, accountability, and transparency issues that have been raised by these events. The Lieutenant Governor and I have been briefed on this plan, and we support it, all of it.
State Police Colonel Kerry Gilpin also says that the reforms are about increasing public trust.
We swore an oath to serve the citizens of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to keep our communities safe. One of the most critical requirements necessary for us to fulfill our mission is to have the trust and confidence of the citizens we serve. It is clear that the actions of members in this agency have threatened that public trust.
Well, for more now, we're joined by WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown. Steve, good to have you.
Good to talk with you, Meghna.
All right, so let's first talk about the elimination of Troop E, the one on the Mass Pike. I mean, that seems to be one of the biggest changes that the governor announced today.
It is, yes. Troop E is the troop that specifically patrols the Massachusetts Turnpike. What they're going to do, they're eliminating it as a standalone troop, and the staff that's there will be absorbed into the other troops that are geographically along the Mass Turnpike. So it's not that they're eliminating the troopers, they're just eliminating that troop itself. Other things are going to be doing, they're going to be doing a lot more audits. They're going to audit the overtime and staffing levels. They're going to look into the possibility of putting in body cameras on troopers. And as you mentioned, they're going to turn on the vehicle tracking equipment, which is already in all the marked cruisers so they can see exactly where those cruisers are and what they're doing.
Okay, so on that point about turning on vehicle tracking technology in marked state trooper vehicles, it seems that it wasn't turned on in some of them. Why is that?
That question was asked of the governor and of Colonel Gilpin. Neither the governor nor the colonel could answer that question. Now, you can kind of speculate in many industries that use that type of technology. There's a lot of pushback from the people who are supposed to be driving those vehicles, saying that it's an invasion of their privacy. It's sort of like Big Brother looking over your shoulder.
Ah, okay. Well, so let's talk a little bit more about using body cams for Massachusetts State Police. I mean, obviously, there's been an ongoing national conversation about body cams. Boston, City of Boston Police are in a pilot program for that. How does that relate to the state police, though?
Well, you know, the state police are going to look at that pilot program that that Boston had implemented and really didn't do a whole lot with once that came to a close. Colonel Gilpin said that they want to use this new technology and will be working with the police unions to implement the technology. Now, like the GPS and the cruisers, you can expect some pushback here. Police officers all across the country have, in some cases, been reluctant to embrace those body cameras because sometimes the evidence that those cameras produces shows that the officer is doing something that they're not supposed to do. And they don't like that.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of this, a lot of these reforms announced today have to do with the fact that there have been a couple of overtime scandals, right? I mean, the Troop F1 out of Massport being the most recent, as reported by The Globe, where an entire troop's salaries were never reported to the state comptroller, at least beginning in 2010. I see that the reforms include, today's reforms announced include some discussions with Massport about that. But did they say anything more specific about what they drew about Troop F?
Well, Troop F, they're going to take a 30-day look at what's been going on over there. They're going to be having some conversations with Massport. Exactly how many police troopers do we need over at Logan Airport day in and day out to wave the traffic on and to be patrolling the airport? So they're going to take a look at those staffing levels over there and work with Massport. Now, why those salaries, those state police salaries, were not reported to the comptroller was that Massport was paying the troopers, and Massport was not required to submit those salaries to the state comptroller. That has changed from now on. Everybody in Troop F will be paid from the state police, and they're going to make sure that all of those records are put on the comptroller's website.
Interesting. So there's a lot here also about just overall increase in transparency with the state police, right? I'm seeing, as you mentioned a little earlier, Steve, some quarterly audits of the top 50 earners at the state police. That's supposed to be made public. And also now the staff assigned to each troop will also now be available to the public. Now, this is something that the state police have been fighting against for years now, saying that it could, using the rules under anti-terrorism laws, that it could affect public safety if they made those staffing decisions public. Do you think there's likely to be pushback from the rank and file?
I think, you know, you may be hearing some things from the union. The union just said that we've just learned of these proposed reforms. We really haven't had a chance to dive in and take a look at it. So they're keeping their powder dry, at least at this point, on their reaction to those kind of changes.
Mm. Well, we actually have some tape here from the State Police Union. This is Dana Pullman, president of the State Police Association, giving initial reaction to today's announcement of these major changes to state police oversight, and on the notion that with ongoing investigations, there are some folks who could perhaps lose their pensions.
That's a broad statement, in my opinion. There's several members of this department that are going to be coming under review, both in the ranks of trooper and sergeant, all the way up to the former colonel of this department, who have investigations going on. So we welcome that. We will defend our people to the utmost of our ability and let the chips fall where they may. If they are in violation, there are procedures and protocols to address those issues with the retirement board and from a criminal nature.
So that's the president of the State Police Association, who also said today that they will work with the department to try and implement reforms in a fair manner. We'll see what that means. Steve, what's likely to happen next? These seem to be major changes.
Yeah, they'll definitely be discussing it with Massport, discussing it with the unions, and try to get those things in. I'm sure you'll be hearing more about these audits that they're conducting after they found the overtime issues. They're going back further into different years to see if there are maybe if this has been going on for many years. They don't know yet. They're going to be looking into that, and I'm sure we'll be hearing about it.
That's Steve Brown, State House reporter for WBUR. Steve, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot, Magna.
All right. Well, let's turn now to Gregory Sullivan. He's current research director at the Pioneer Institute of Boston. He was formerly the state inspector general. He served two terms under Governors Romney and Patrick. And during that time, as state inspector general, he was tasked with investigating waste, fraud, and abuse in the government. Gregory Sullivan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Just wondering what your sort of top line takeaway is from today's announcement about these major reforms to the state police.
Well, the big takeaway is that the governor has really taken very stern action, eliminating Troop E. I mean, that's about as big as it can get. They're going to now, I mean, that was kind of a plum assignment and a big money assignment for overtime. And I think that the action there to disband the troop and have the troopers assigned geographically is kind of giving away that big monopoly perk on a lot of the overtime.
Right. And they also said that in the next 30 days, there'll be a study of overtime in each of the Turnpike barracks as well.
Yes. And another thing which Steve Brown and you talked about has to do with Troop F at Massport, at Logan Airport. And that is going to be a 30-day review. Now, I think you were very smart to mention the fact that the state troopers at Massport have inordinately high overtime mm-hmm. with moving traffic. So if somebody drops off or picks up a passenger at Logan, there's a state trooper assigned to do that. Now, at other airports, I was just out at Orlando Airport, many, many airports in the country, they don't have police, state police doing this. It's done by airport personnel. And, you know, they assign to tell people to keep moving, get to the cell phone lot. That's a lot of money. That's being paid.
Yeah.
The question is, should they have monopoly rights to that under the two state trooper unions?
Well, so let me ask you about that, Greg Sullivan, because you know today's announcement, I think, is very, they're sweeping and refreshing, because it seems as if Governor Baker and Colonel Gilpin are trying to bring a new era of transparency to the state police, which is long overdue. But I think you are getting to something just as important, that there may be some sort of structural issues underlying all that that got us to this place. And did you hear anything in the announcements today that would get at those structural issues?
Yeah, I think, well, one thing I take away from this is that Kay Gilpin, who's the new leader at Massport, is really tough.
She's in the state police.
She's really tough. And you see what they're doing here is not, you know, it's not a laid-back response. But, you know, the state police has a, you know, they have a big problem with very, very highly paid people. There were more than 700 state troopers and officers who made more than Governor Baker in 2017. Imagine that. I mean, if you look at a printout of the most highly paid state employees, it's basically monopolized by state troopers and UMass administrators. So there's just more than 200 employees made more than $200,000. 243 of them made overtime in excess of $50,000.
Right.
I mean, in other words, very, very big numbers.
Well, I mean, are you saying that, you know, in regards to the state police, that right now we have a system that's built to maximize the potential for overtime pay?
That's my take on this system, is that there are some agencies in government, and this one, I think, is one, where there's really no built-in incentive to avoid overtime, because the people who are enjoying the overtime and other pay, which is details, etc.,
yeah.
They're the ones making the decision, but they're partaking in it.
I got you.
And there have been historical disputes between the regular troopers and the officers of the state police about the officers hogging the overtime. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there's like a lot of interest in maximizing overtime, and that's not what should be going on.
Right. Greg Sullivan, I just got two more quick questions for you. One, I wonder what you make of the fact that one thing we haven't talked about in much detail is that there are some reviews, additional reviews going on of the state police, one out of the Attorney General's office. Do you have confidence that those reviews will be sufficiently independent?
Well, I think that Maura Healey, the Attorney General, has a very good reputation. I think she will do an excellent job. But if it were up to me, I would have this review done by the State Inspector General. The State Inspector General's name is Glenn Cunha. He used to be with the Attorney General's office. But, you know, the Attorney General's office investigative team are state troopers. And it's human nature. It's tough when you're investigating yourself, you know. So I think that at the very least, the state IG's office, who that's had a lot of experience with theft of time cases, that's what this is called, in the past and success, should be in charge of this investigation.
Interesting. Now, last question for you, Greg Sullivan. I really appreciate your insight on this, because you were Inspector General for the
yes.
Commonwealth of Massachusetts, left that post in 2012. Some of these issues with the state police, you know, began during the time you were Inspector General. Were these issues ever brought to you while
yes.
you were in office?
Yeah, yes, there were. If you go look back at the history, there have been many instances in questions raised about the state police and specifically about overtime. It's been noted by many investigative journalists that the state troopers and state police officers just break every record when it comes to overtime. It's so big that it's really impinged on the budget. I mean, the overtime for the state police is gigantic in comparison to their base.
Makes you wonder why the state didn't act until now, then.
Well, it does. You're right.
Well, Gregory Sullivan, he's currently research director at the Pioneer Institute, former state inspector general under Governors Romney and Governor Patrick. Greg Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I am joined now in the studio by Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Meghna.
It's always a good Monday when I see you here. Now, we're calling this the last conversation we'll ever need to have about eating right. And
right.
I should note that that title is a nod, a very vigorous nod to the headline of a
stolen nod.
Hugely popular article that's just out in New York Magazine.
Right. And it's basically a long, long set of questions and answers about what's healthy to eat by the famous food writer Mark Bittman and a leading preventive medicine specialist, Dr. David Katz, who's the founding director of Yale University's Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center. So they take all these questions, and the questions range very widely
from
the paleo diet to gluten to protein bars and
cleansing,
anything you can think of, it's in there. And Dr. Katz tells me it's looking to be the most popular article the magazine has ever published, possibly.
Okay, so I mean, he and Mark Bittman answered dozens and dozens of questions from readers, I guess.
Readers and staffers and anyone who wanted to kind of send them in.
Okay,
yes.
Anything you ever wanted to know about diet, nutrition, but were they hit with any that they simply did not know the answers to?
Well, it does sound like some of the questions they were asked were pretty quirky.
I mean, how much Greek yogurt is too much? It's an absurd question. What does that mean? Too much for what? You know, too much for health, too much because you can't fit any more in your stomach. We had no idea what the question meant.
And that's Dr. Katz, right?
Right, that's
okay,
Dr. Katz,
okay.
Yes.
And I would just say that I don't think Greek yogurt is magical anyway. I just think they remove a lot of the water content from regular yogurt, and that's why it's more protein per bite rather than something fundamentally different.
Okay, so listeners, you heard it here first, the hard-hitting expose of Greek yogurt, yes, by Meghna Chakrabarty. But mainly, you know, overall, the response to this piece has been huge.
Okay, and I mean, to have a serious moment here, I mean, I would say that's because we are all constantly confused about what we should eat.
I know.
You know, like, we kind of know, but with every additional study, it seems like the ground is always shifting. Low fat, low carb, probiotics, prebiotics, good fats, bad fats. You know, I can go on.
Yes, on and on and on. It's a personal conundrum every day, really, or at the supermarket, at the restaurant. But it's also a big national health challenge, and the stakes are very high. So here's Dariush Muzaffarian. He's the dean of the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University.
Food right now is causing more deaths and disability in the United States than any other factor, including tobacco smoking. We really have a national and really global nutrition crisis. And so, for example, by our estimates, poor eating is leading to nearly 1,000 deaths per day from cardiovascular diseases, obesity, and diabetes. So this is really a challenge we have to face.
And we have to face it nationally and personally.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, so back to this New York Magazine with the magazine article with Dr. David Katz and Mark Bittman answering all these questions. Mm-hmm. Let's tackle a couple of the questions that they take on here. Carbs. Are carbs evil?
Yes, so they are.
They are not.
So, no. Bittman and Katz write, carbs as evil is probably the silliest of all silly pop culture propaganda about diet and health. And their reasoning is, it's a little obscure actually, but their reasoning is that because all plant-based foods, all the best stuff like vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, nuts, seeds, those are all technically carbs. And so their point is that it's not that carbs are evil. Junk food is evil.
Okay, so it's the type of carbs that they're talking about, really. I mean, okay, so
don't want food that's been robbed of its nutrients.
Well, because technically, sugar is a carbohydrate, right? Technically,
right?
Is sugar bad? I mean, I thought all the nutrition studies are telling me it's the great evil right now.
They Is sugar a toxin? I mean, there's that school of thought. What Bittman and Katz write is that their main worry about sugar is weight gain, obviously, and that it triggers appetite. So they say, like, just limit processed food and ideally try not to eat foods with added sugar unless they're a dessert. So watch out for the sugar in pasta sauce, salad dressing, yogurt, you know, that kind.
Unless it's a dessert. That's right. My out here. Okay.
Dessert.
No. So what about this one? I like this question that they took on again. This was in New York Magazine. Mm-hmm. Quote, my friend is always talking about inducing ketosis. Mm-hmm. What is that? And by the way, this friend is apparently losing weight.
Losing weight on ketosis. Yeah. So for the uninitiated, Bittman and Katz write that a ketogenic diet is a diet that starves the body of glucose sources so that it's forced to burn ketone bodies, which are products of fat metabolism, as fuel. They say there's no good evidence that it's really good for you. And sure, you know, your friend might be losing weight, but I love this. They write, not everything that causes weight loss in the short term is a good idea. Cholera, for instance, causes weight loss, blood sugar, blood lipids to come down, but that doesn't mean you
certainly do not. Okay, what about vegetables? Someone asked them that they've heard frozen vegetables can be healthier than fresh. Is that possibly true?
So isn't this interesting? They say it can be true, especially if the vegetables were flash frozen right after being harvested, because with vegetables, age is everything, and freezing retards the aging. So there's kind of a hierarchy. Like, the best vegetables are fresh and locally sourced, but flash frozen is next as good. And those quote-unquote fresh vegetables that spend a long time in storage or transit are probably the least nutritious.
I see. So the key thing is the time in storage or transit for those fresh vegetables.
Or before
freezing.
Underscore.
That's like a little sort of subtle props for local food. Yay.
Yes.
Okay. Now, those were just some of the dozens and dozens of questions that Katz and Bittman took on. Again, as you mentioned earlier, everything from the paleo diet to juice cleanses to everything, salts, mm-hmm. like all mm-hmm. of it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, folks listening now, Carrie, I'm sure, are wondering, so overall, what should we eat?
Right. The eternal, just tell me what to eat. And you know that famous Michael Pollan formulation, eat food, not too much, mostly plants, that's really not too bad. But I asked Dean Mozafarian, and he says it's actually really hard to wrap up the complexity of nutrition in just a few words, but basically try to eat a Mediterranean diet.
So, you know, plenty of healthy fats, healthy oils, fish, nuts, fruits, beans, you know, many minimally processed foods that are bioactive. And then there's only really a handful of things to minimize, but those things represent, you know, about half the calories in the food supply.
And those things are mostly the highly processed foods that are rich in sugar or starch or salt or trans fats. Yeah, the best.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm only laughing because I'm thinking about what I ate today.
I saw you eat today.
Two giant pieces of pizza. So I'm thinking all that flour in the pizza dough.
Yeah, so don't go to the guilty place. Like, probably my favorite thing that Dean Mozafarian said is that, you know, it's fine for industry and for us as consumers to focus on reducing the bad. Like, for industry, it's getting additives out of food, you know, less salt, less sugar, less fat. But he suggests focusing on increasing the good. So instead, you know, thinking about how to eat more fruit, more nuts, fish, healthy oils, vegetables, beans, just more good stuff.
Got it. So next time I'm eating my toddler's leftover soggy cereal, just like slice some bananas on it.
Yeah, and then it's all good.
Okay, got it. Yeah. But okay, Carrie, I mean, when you tried to sort of consolidate digest this information down to a takeaway, it's like, you know, eat the healthy Mediterranean diet. But I feel like we've been hearing this forever.
So, yeah, I mean, I know. We kind of have, right? We know what the better foods are. So I asked Dr. David Katz whether sometimes he feels like the women who were carrying signs at the Women's March that said, I can't believe I still have to carry this sign, right? And he says it is true that the fundamentals of good nutrition haven't changed that much over his career. They've evolved a little bit. But yeah, basically, he's been fighting pretty much the same fight for most of 30 years.
It is sort of unbelievable that we are committed to exploring every possible way there is to eat badly and refuse to accept the fundamental truth that every time, any place, in any population, anywhere in the world, people thrive. They thrive on a diet of real food, not too much, mostly plants. They eat lots of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, and drink plain water when thirsty. It is sort of unbelievable we can't get that message across.
Yeah.
Right? But of course, it's because we don't want to believe it. We keep hoping there's going to be some magical way to eat everything we want and still be healthy and thin. And there's not.
There's no magic. No magic. Sorry. But I really encourage everyone to go to our website, radioboston.org. Obviously, take a look at all the links we have to the Common Health there. But also, we have a link to the New York Magazine article as well. Because the one thing they did this time around is they took all this information and wrote it in a really entertaining way. So hopefully the message will get across, right?
Maybe this time. Maybe.
Well, Carrie Goldberg, she is the head of WBUR's Common Health section. Carrie, thank you as always.
I want to eat a donut now.
No! No, I was going to say, here's to olive oil and feta cheese.
Fine, let's have that.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's a bit of a salty quote, so a tiny bit of a language warning, but it's worth listening to. Here goes. It goes, if that girl had been born with balls, she would have been a hell of a politician. Well, that's what Joseph Kennedy once said of his daughter Eunice. But of course, in the Kennedy clan, it was the men who were groomed for political stardom. The women were meant to support them. But in her magnificent new biography, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eileen McNamara makes the persuasive case that of all the Kennedys and all of their accomplishments, it was Eunice who had the greatest, most lasting impact on American life. Take, for example, the creation of Special Olympics. It celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, and it'll feature almost 5 million athletes from more than 170 countries. Now, back in 1997, we have this bit of tape here from Eunice Kennedy Shriver speaking at the, 1987 Special Olympics.
The right to play on any playing field, you have earned it. The right to study in any school, you have earned it. The right to hold a job, you have earned it. The days of separation and segregation are over.
Now, in that little bit of tape, you hear Eunice Kennedy Shriver talking about seeking dignity and justice for those with intellectual disabilities. And that's why McNamara says that it was Eunice who helped bring about one of the great civil rights achievements of our time. The new book is called Eunice, The Kennedy Who Changed the World, and Eileen McNamara joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna.
So I'm a little ashamed to say this, Eileen, but I didn't have any idea, other than the founding of Special Olympics, that Eunice Kennedy Shriver was as accomplished as she was.
Well, I don't think I had any idea either until I began doing the research for this book.
So what made you want to start looking at who she was?
Well, you know, there's a coincidence of the timing of her death and Senator Ted Kennedy's death. And you may remember that period.
Oh, yes.
It was in 2009, and Eunice died 2 weeks before Ted. And she was buried from a little clapboard church on the Cape. And as you recall, Senator Kennedy lay in repose at the Kennedy Library. His body was flown to Washington, where he was taken through the city. To the Capitol and laid to rest beside his brothers. And the contrast struck me.
Right. I mean, I recall that time exquisitely well because I was actually assigned to the Kennedy Library to cover the thousands of people who wanted to walk past Ted Kennedy's casket to pay their respects. And I filed, I don't know, a couple dozen stories in those several days. And it didn't even occur to me once that his sister had died exactly 14 days before that.
She had, indeed. Yeah. And I'm not suggesting at all that Senator Kennedy didn't deserve that attention. But history has a way of overlooking women. And Eunice Kennedy Shriver was a remarkable woman who has been overlooked.
Well, I know that you're undoing history's oversight of Eunice with this book, but I was wondering if you could actually just read us a little bit from the introduction here where you describe sort of how, you know, in part because of who the Kennedys were themselves and their family patriarch, about why maybe we don't recognize Eunice as much as we should today.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Invisible or interchangeable, that was the lot of the daughters of Joseph P. and Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy, relegated to the role of decorative accessories to the outside ambitions, first of their father and then their brothers. Charming London society when Joe was U ambassador to the Court of St. James in the late 30s, hosting ladies' teas during Jack's first congressional race a decade later.
accompanying one of their brothers during the continual campaign that defined the Kennedys' lives for more than half a century. From Jack's ascendancy as the first Catholic president through Bobby's ill-fated run for the White House to Ted's long career in the Senate, Eunice, Pat, and Jean, the three Kennedy sisters not lost young to tragedy, were a silent backdrop to the nation's storied political dynasty. In the case of Eunice, that image was wildly out of focus. There was nothing silent or ornamental about the fifth of Joe and Rose Kennedy's nine children. Even as she hatched the idea for those tea parties, Eunice chafed at such a circumcised role for what was fast becoming the family business. "Dear Daddy, I know you are very busy," she wrote to her father at Hyannisport, probably in the late 50s. "I also know that you are advising everyone else in that house on their careers, so why not me?"
That's Eileen McNamara reading from her new biography of Eunice Kennedy Shriver. It's called Eunice, the Kennedy Who Changed the World. That letter where that you quote Eunice asking her father, Joe, why wasn't he advising her? I mean, did he ever respond to that?
Not that we know of. I don't have a letter from him in return. And the fact is, Eunice knew why not.
Because she was a woman.
And his focus was on getting one of his sons elected to the presidency, Jack first, maybe Bobby next, if he had his way. The girls were just overlooked.
Yeah. It's amazing, though, because I mean, they were overlooked in terms of their public potential by Joe Kennedy. Right. But it seems as if members of the Kennedy clan recognized Eunice's innate talent. Like early on in the book, you write how even as Eunice Kennedy, she was born in 1921, right?
Yes.
That even as a young girl, her mother Rose, she would keep these lovely little note cards about
right.
each of the children, and Rose looked back at the note cards and said that Eunice, even as a young girl, was wonderfully well-coordinated, one of the best athletes in the family, a talker with a special way of expressing herself, also a good listener, marvelously generous in her interest in others, especially her brothers and sisters, but also including waifs, strays, and anyone who needed her. So it seemed like she sort of stood out from the start.
Well, I think she probably did. I'm not sure that those are the ways in which she stood out. I mean, the story of Eunice is often portrayed as this compassionate, lovely heiress who did good works. Well, there was nothing particularly nice about Eunice Kennedy Shriver. She was a tough cookie. And I think she was propelled in her life as much by rage as she was by compassion.
So rage because of her sister?
Rage because of her sister.
So her sister Rosemary.
Her sister Rosemary.
The one who was given a lobotomy.
She was lobotomized in 1941 when she was 23 years old. It was perhaps a well-intentioned but clearly misguided attempt on Joe's part to deal with the mental illnesses that compounded her intellectual disabilities. And it was an abysmal failure.
Right.
A disaster for Rosemary. She was left unable to speak or walk.
And then so after that lobotomy in 1941, she was essentially shut away.
She was. She was confined to a psychiatric hospital north of New York City for 9 years, where she got no rehabilitation at all. And in 1949, she was transferred out to Wisconsin to a Catholic institution that did do rehabilitative work with people with intellectual disabilities. And she eventually did learn to talk, not much. She couldn't say very many words. One of the words she could say was Eunice. And she could walk again.
Okay. Now, in 1961 or 62, it was Eunice, after Joseph Kennedy's stroke, it was Eunice who brought her sister back into the fold, so to speak.
She brought her right back into the heart of the family.
But in those intervening 20 years, what did you discover about what Eunice knew and how she reacted to, like, her sister who just basically had vanished from the family's life?
Well, I think it says volumes about the power that Joe Kennedy exerted over his wife and his children, that he laid down the law that Rosemary was not to be part of the family, that doctors had advised him it wasn't good for her to be part of such a competitive crew, and that she shouldn't receive visits from them. So they didn't visit.
Huh. So she, even though she had this sort of simmering rage, as you say, about her sister and the way her sister was treated, she never questioned her father?
Well, we don't know that.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of holes in the story of Rosemary, because over the years, the Kennedys told quite a variety of stories, and most of them weren't accurate. So what we don't know the full extent of what Eunice knew and when she knew it. I did discover a letter in the Kennedy Library from Rose to St. Coletta's, which is the institution where Rosemary lived. And it was a letter that came in the 1970s in which they were replacing Rosemary's physician. And Rose said, I'll pass this on to Mrs. Shriver, because Mrs. Shriver was involved with the original decision about her medical care when she first went to St. Coletta's. Mm-hmm. Well, that would have been 1949. So perhaps Joe told her then.
Okay. But we don't really know.
We don't really know.
So for Eunice Kennedy, in, as you write in the biography, the backdrop of what happened to Rosemary is key to understanding who Eunice is and who she became. So we have that backdrop, but I want to get into some of the details that you write about so beautifully about Eunice's life and her accomplishments as well. In those years where Rosemary was out of the picture, just as an aside, there's this wonderful, you bring up a couple of quotes that describe her as maybe the best sailor in the family, mm-hmm. which I love because they're all the iconic images of the Kennedys on sailboats. It's all the Kennedy men. But here we hear that Eunice was fantastic on the water as well, and also really great, strong athlete. And
she was a remarkable athlete. In fact, I didn't put this story in the book, but it's a classic. Vicky Kennedy, Ted's second wife, learned how to sail in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And she won a competition in her little sailboat. And so Eunice offered to have a party for her at her house in Hyannisport. So Vicky told me she was thrilled and excited to go to this party. And when they got there, Eunice had taken out every sailing trophy that she had ever won and displayed them all over the dining room table.
So you may have won one, but look at all these.
That's right. So competitive to the end. Yeah.
But so I hadn't realized until I read the book that Eunice actually played quite a key role in Jack Kennedy's early political career, right? I mean, you write about how she was showed to have some intense political savvy at a young age, right? That Jack Kennedy had Eunice give some of his speeches for his House race in the mid 40s, and it was her idea, as you mentioned earlier, to hold these tea parties to get women behind the Kennedy candidacy. All of that came from her,
right? And in 1946, she was his surrogate. There were often times when he had to be in two places at once, and he dispatched Eunice. She loved to give speeches. She was very good at it. The tea parties were the brainchild of Eunice and a city councilman in Cambridge. And all of Jack's advisors said it was a terrible idea, that better to spend the money on beer busts for all the young men just back from World War II, because nobody would show up. And people not only showed up, but there were lines of women around the block at the Hotel Commander in Harvard Square in Cambridge.
So is that when Jack Kennedy learned to sort of implicitly trust his sister's ideas and strategy?
I think he did. And when he went to Washington in 1947, she went with him.
Right. And you talked about how she they would throw dinner parties. They lived together.
They did. They were roommates.
And when the men would retire to another room to talk politics after dinner, she'd go with them.
She went with them. She left the ladies in the parlor to gossip. And she lit up her own stogie so that she smoked cigars with them as well.
Wow. Now, it seems as if Jack Kennedy recognized his sister's potential, but you write how there's a period between the, you know, the late 40s, early 50s, and when she finally marries Sergeant Shriver many years later, where she actually had talked about to her father, I think, she wanted to, instead of getting married, she wanted to continue being socially active. She was looking at criminal justice for young people, things like that. And Joe Kennedy didn't want any of it.
Right. He was happy to have her work, but she worked for the Justice Department on a initiative on juvenile delinquency in 1947 and 48. And he was happy to have her do that, but only if it was a little interim period between college and marriage. But Eunice, in fact, wanted to become a nun. She, in service of her social work, she felt the Catholic Church offered women few leadership positions, but the sisters that she studied with, at the Sisters of the Sacred Heart, were role models for her. And I went to London to the boarding school where she was taught by the Sisters of the Sacred Heart, and found one of her old classmates who herself had become a nun. And Sister Dorothy Bell told me that of all of her classmates, everyone was more sure that Eunice had a vocation, even that she herself had a vocation.
Wow. But Joe Kennedy didn't want that.
He did not.
Oh, because he wanted his son to become the first president who was a Catholic, and having his sister, I guess, become a nun wouldn't have helped that?
Well, can you imagine the optics of a woman in a black
in a wimple, right.
And a wimple and a black veil. I don't think at the time it would have been very helpful for
Interesting. So her ambitions in that front were subjugated to that of her brothers.
But they were thwarted, I would say. Yeah. Not just subjugated. And in service of convincing her not to become a nun, he impressed Father Ted Hesburgh, the president of Notre Dame, to call Eunice down from Chicago, where she was living and doing social work, to tell her that she did not have a vocation, that her vocation was to marry Sergeant Shriver.
Wow.
And Father Hesburgh told that story for decades, but never on the record.
Huh. Until now.
Until now. And he's died since. But when I called him, he was 97 years old, and he waited a long time on the phone as he paused to think about whether he would confirm it. And he said, well, they're all dead now. It can't hurt anybody. Yes. I did do that.
Wow. Well, perhaps it was for the best, though, because I think the thing that my eyes were most open to in this book, in this biography, Eileen, is that you write about so many things that have the Kennedy name attached to it, but it's Jack Kennedy's name, whereas really it was Eunice who was the brains and the motivating and the political force behind it. Like, for example, can you tell us about the story of how the Mental Retardation Facilities and Community Mental Health Center Construction Act of 1963 was passed?
I can. Yeah. Jack Kennedy had no public record in the United States Senate on what we then called mental retardation. He was, in fact, on the committee that would have heard legislation, the first legislation on the federal level that would have provided federal money for special education. And he walked out of the hearing room. So he comes to the presidency with no track record. Before he even takes the oath of office, Eunice makes him commit to impaneling what she called the President's Panel on Mental Retardation. She picked all 27 members of that panel. Huh. And she served as a consultant on that panel, where they wrote the legislation that you just described. It happened to be the last piece of legislation Jack Kennedy ever saw signed. But she wrote it, and she wrote it with these 27 experts. Never served on the panel herself. She was a consultant to the panel because she said years later, well, the nepotism wouldn't have looked right. You think Bobby said that when they appointed him Attorney General?
Obviously not.
Or that Ted said that when he ran for Jack's seat in the United States Senate from Massachusetts. I don't think so.
Wow. I mean, so there's so much. Obviously, this was a life's calling for her to advocate for, you know, treating those with intellectual disabilities with dignity and with justice. That she goes on to, through her work as really being the head of the Kennedy Family Foundation, right?
Right.
She ends up founding what becomes what? Well, she ended up founding the Special Olympics.
Right. She basically hijacked the family's charitable foundation, and she turned its focus exclusively to intellectual disabilities. And it's interesting to note that for all of the years the Kennedy Foundation was operating in a vibrant way, the name of the president was either Jack Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, or Ted Kennedy. And they had nothing to do with the foundation. She ran it. She set its priorities. She did the work. They got the credit.
I mean, we're only scraping the surface of all the things that you write about that Eunice Kennedy really has her fingerprints on. So that's why I want everyone to read the biography. But you also, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, you write about how she wasn't a saint, right?
No.
She was impatient, didn't really maybe have time for a lot of the social mores of the 50s and 60s. Sometimes maybe a slight, a loving but distant mother.
Yes,
as
I think
well.
That's fair.
Okay,
yeah.
So it's a fair biography on that point. But I'm wondering what you think of this. Your biography of Eunice Kennedy Shriver is coming out at the same time where we have yet another pop culture representation of the male Kennedys through the new Chappaquiddick movie that's coming out.
Right.
And that got me thinking, did you ever find out about what Eunice herself, so smart, so effective, so full of potential, what she thought about the way her family, and particularly her brothers, how they treated women?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think Maria Shriver describes her mother best, I think, on this point.
Yeah.
When she says that her adoration is pretty close to the right word, of Jack, didn't allow her to accept what she knew to be true. She was his roommate in the 40s. There were a parade of secretaries and stewardesses going out of that townhouse in Georgetown. There's no way that she didn't know. But she was able to just divide her consciousness so that she didn't accept it. She was much tougher on Teddy. You know, after his divorce from Joan, and when he was in his sort of wild period, she was all over him.
Oh, interesting.
But she didn't tolerate anyone criticizing him publicly, especially her children. Anthony Shriver was at Georgetown when Ted was in that period, and he would run into Ted in the bars in Georgetown. And he would say, "Mom, I saw Teddy last night. He was," and he would begin to proceed to talk about his wild evening. And his mother would say, "Well, did you see him on the floor of the Senate this morning? Let's go talk to Ted and let's get that speech that he gave. It's a wonderful speech, Anthony, wonderful speech."
Hmm.
So she deflected a lot.
Yeah. But so, I mean, in that case, in Eunice's case, though, maybe she might have been privately willing to be more critical of Ted Kennedy, but it sounds like publicly she was still very much loyal to her family.
Oh, she was the most loyal of anyone in the family.
Yeah. So interesting. I mean, I get it. Like, family is family,
right,
no matter who you are. But on the other hand, I mean, you quote that Bobby Kennedy once said that Eunice probably would have made as good of president as anybody,
right,
in the family.
That's Bobby Jr., yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, but she had to know that.
Oh, she knew it. She absolutely knew it. And she resented it. I mean, then she gave a wonderful speech 2 years before she died at the Kennedy Library when finally they had an evening to celebrate her accomplishments. And she said, "I grew up hearing that real power was not for me." And she knew it was. She wielded it. She just wielded it behind the scenes.
Yeah. Well, we actually have another little clip from that very speech.
Ah.
Again, this is Eunice Kennedy Shriver in 2007 at the JFK Library. They were celebrating her. And she thanked everyone for coming and said this in part about her life.
"I am lucky that I experienced the sting of rejection as a woman who was told that the real power was not for me. I am lucky that I saw my mother and my sister Rosemary treated with unbearable rejection. The combination of the love of my family and the awful sting of rejection helped me to develop the confidence that I needed to believe that I could make a difference in a positive direction."
Now, is that her sort of pounding the
lectern?
I
was going to say, if you listen, you can hear her pounding the lectern. She was a very angry woman.
Yeah. I mean, it has to make you wonder, what if, right?
Yes.
What if she'd been born a generation or two later?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question that she would have been in public office.
Yeah. So in the last minute that we have, it seems as if when you look at the totality of Eunice Kennedy Shriver's life, and also she lived to be 88, so one of the longest lived Kennedys, I can see why you're making the case that she has had more impact on more people than any of the Kennedy men. But even more than Ted Kennedy, I mean, he was in the Senate for 50 years.
He was in the Senate for 50 years. And during a lot of those years, he was carrying Eunice's water. a lot of the legislation that he is justifiably credited for found its origins in her head, not his head. I mean, in 1975 was the first time that a child born with intellectual disabilities had a right to a public school classroom seat. That was Eunice. That wasn't Ted.
Wow. Well, the new biography is Eunice, the Kennedy who changed the world. It is Eileen McNamara's biography of Eunice Kennedy Shriver. Eileen is a Pulitzer Prize-winning former columnist for the Boston Globe and now the director of the journalism program at Brandeis University. Eileen will also be speaking tomorrow night at the JFK Presidential Library. We've got information about the event at radioboston.org. It has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for the book, Eileen, and thank you for coming in.
Well, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.